I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And you're listening to Mind the Gap. Mind the Gap is a podcast dedicated to discovering the minds behind the people bringing science to society. From challenges to opportunities, we uncover the impact of research on policy, community, and ultimately, you. So sit back, relax, and please, mind the gap. Today we have an exciting new episode. So Teresa and I got the opportunity to attend the Societal Impact of Science Conference. This is run by the Network for Advancing and Evaluating the Societal Impact of Science, also known as the ASIS Network. So Teresa, do you want to briefly tell our listeners what this conference is all about?
Yes, I do. So this was actually the 11th annual conference held on the Societal Impact of Science. This conference brings together various stakeholders in and outside of science to engage on the most effective approaches for implementing policies, strategies, methods, and tools to optimize societal impact of science and evaluate success.
Okay, so for all of our non-research impact expert listeners out there, basically, in layman's terms, the purpose of this conference is to bring together a bunch of experts on research impact to talk about how do we measure the impact of science and how can we translate this science into the society in a way that we can actually use it.
Yes. So,
before we get into today's episode, we have a fun new segment for our podcast. So if you've listened to our previous episodes, we have done first date questions to get to know our guests. But in our new segment, we are doing Would You Rather? So in this case, we are going to be asking niche research topics and what you would rather be a part of. All right, Teresa, would you rather investigate whether dog fleas or cat fleas can jump higher or investigate whether or not woodpeckers get headaches?
I think I would go with the second, investigating whether woodpeckers get headaches. I've always been very curious about woodpeckers and how, you know, I know their tongue wraps around their brain to kind of combat any trauma, obviously, or else, you know, they wouldn't be alive for much longer. But it is an interesting thought. Like, do they get a headache from all that woodpecking?
Yeah, I know. I never really thought to explore this subject, but good thing the ophthalmologist, Ivan Schwab, looked into the cure for headache by publishing his article in the British Journal of Ophthalmology. And in his paper, he discovers some physiological traits that woodpeckers have to avoid brain damage and bleeding or detaching their eyes hammering their beaks into trees. So it's apparently due to a surprisingly squishy skull and sturdy jaw muscles. Oh, they also have relatively small brains, which explains a lot.
Just a lot of folds. A small brain, but very folded.
Yeah.
So they're still smart.
I really like when researchers look into different animals to try and uncover something. I remember we had this discussion in my anthropology class about hibernating bears.
Yeah.
And whether or not we can use information we know about the way that bears' bones work to see if we can help against, you know, deteriorating bone matter in bed rest patients.
Yeah.
Because these bears, they hibernate for long periods of time and then they just get up and walk
and
normally.
Yeah.
But if you were bed rest for like even a week.
Oh my gosh, the atrophy.
Yeah, it would be very detrimental. Yeah. So this seems very similar in looking at.
Yeah, and even if you think about a lot of things from like architectural design or engineering or the way we get things to work in the world are from nature influence. So it makes sense that we would also turn to nature for ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which one would you pick?
I think I would choose the same. Yeah. Not to discredit the dog fleas or cat fleas. For more information on this one, it seems that a paper was published in 2000 called A Comparison of Jump Performances, the Dog Flea and the Cat Flea. And it declared that the dog flea was the winner.
Ooh, yay.
So, yeah. The canine inclined insects jump both higher and farther than felines. And, yeah, the research team scooped an Annals of Improbable Research Nobel Prize in the biology category. Who even knew that existed? Right.
These fleas don't know how famous they are.
Yeah. Well, this says the Ig Nobel Prize gets awarded for feats that make people laugh and then think.
Interesting.
So I like that. Yeah. A little bit of like good morale out there, you know? Yeah. All right. Well, back into our our discussion about the ACES conference. Before we get into this episode, we do want to put a little bit of a disclaimer out there. So we were guests at this conference, but Teresa and I are far from being experts in this field.
We went into this conference knowing very little about societal impact of science. And, you know, I think we have a concept and grasp on how science might impact society, mm-hmm. but this was a whole other ballgame, so we were learning.
Yes. So this is going to be an account of our personal experience, the information that resonated with us the most.
Yes.
And I think it's good. I think these types of conferences really desire having guests like us who have a lot to learn.
Yeah.
So there will be a lot of good content covered in this, but just disclaimer.
We're not coming from an expert.
We're not experts at all in this field. All right. So do you want to take it away with a day one of the conference?
So day one of the conference was all about transforming policies to stimulate and assess the impact of science. We started with a speaker named Stephanie Warner, University of Calgary, Manager Knowledge Engagement.
Mm-hmm.
So she talked a lot about DORA, which DORA stands for Declaration on Research Assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really interesting because it's a way of improving the ways that researchers and the output of scholarly research are evaluated.
Okay.
And it's this evaluation system that they've come up with in order to stimulate and assess the impact of research on society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really liked this talk. This was one of the first talks, and I had no idea where it was going when I was listening to it. But after I read a little bit more about DORA and just how it can be implemented, I think it's a really good movement. So I think the main thing, and we'll come back to this over and over again in this episode, is one of the biggest challenges with assessing impact of science is how do we you know, assess the impact that you're doing. I think a big easy example of this is maybe you found the cure for cancer, but how is that impact different, and how can you assess it compared to doing basic science like stuff that you see a lot in physics or math or something like that? And how can you evaluate them equally?
Equally, yeah. Right? Have a fair playing field.
Yeah. And so I think previously, like what's traditionally done is looking at something called H-index or impact factor or whatever, and looking at which journals you've published in and stuff like that. And while those are quantifiable measures, the biggest issue with them is it doesn't take into account the differences across fields.
Yes.
You know, we always talk about, like, man, if we were doing rat research,
I mean, we could be publishing out those papers.
Yes.
And, you know, this is coming also from a non-rat researcher, so maybe it's very hard to acquire your rat participants.
Yes, but
in comparison to humans.
Human participants are hard to come by, and, you know, they don't. Like, you're doing a 5-part study, and, you know, sometimes
they don't always want to do all 5.
Yeah, exactly. So it can be really difficult and time consuming. And so while someone out there is publishing like hundreds of papers, you might only be publishing one per a few years, right? Yeah. And it also doesn't take into account longitudinal studies that yes. are supposed to take a long yeah. time. So what DORA is trying to do is it's trying to be like an explicit set of criteria that is used to look at things like hiring, tenure, and promotion. And it clearly highlights, just especially for early stage investigators, you know, the scientific content of a paper is much more important than the publication metrics.
Yeah, itself, so, yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool. And it's not adopted by every university.
No.
But it has been adopted by funding agencies mm-hmm. and universities like the University of Calgary. So I think it's definitely a step in the right direction.
Yeah, definitely. And just even from the sounds of it, the questions from audience members, it sounds like a lot more universities are going to be adopting DORA.
Yeah. Yeah. And I talked to our principal investigator, and he's like, oh, do you know about DORA? So it seems like people know about yeah. it. But first time we ever yeah. heard of it. So we're in the upcoming, students going yeah. into academia. So it's a good thing to know about early. So the next speaker that we listened to was Calla Stevenson. She's a senior analyst doing science and emerging technology policy at RAND Europe in the UK. So she brought up the concept of the Research Excellence Framework, or the REF. And so this, I think, from what I understood, is a very similar framework to what, like, Canada's NSERC and CIHR yeah. follow. So it's just guiding how funding is allocated in the UK.
Yeah.
So again, not an expert on the REF, but what was really cool was that this conference brought together different countries and different country policies to talk about how they guide their funding.
Yes.
And I think this is like a really good way to kind of come together and find solutions for
measuring research
impact. And, you know, people in the UK can trial and error some things. We can trial and error some yeah. things over here, and then we can learn from each other. And I think the biggest takeaway that I got from this presentation was that impact is not linear.
Yes.
Yeah. So there was yeah. some pretty graphs that she showed, but it's basically just saying that, you know, there's not just one path to research impact. You don't have to follow like a series of steps in
like
a recipe.
ABC.
Yeah. yeah. You can come to the same research impact using several hundreds of different methods.
Yes.
And they kind of do research to look at that and mm-hmm. do like all this. I don't know if meta-analysis would be the right word for that, but
very pretty graphs. Very I know pretty. That.
And they did a comparison in like research impact between, I think, years 2015 and
yeah.
maybe 2020, something mm-hmm. like that, and just seeing how things change over the years and stuff like that. So, again, very valuable work that's happening out of there.
Yeah, definitely.
And yeah, I think the main takeaways I got was just collaboration amongst different countries and different policies, and then also just impact not linear.
Yes. And I think that's a really important point to mm-hmm. note, that not just in terms of, because I feel like when we're talking about research impact, that's such a macro level, but mm-hmm. even at the micro level, like within our lab, knowing that, you know, there might be some years where we feel really impactful with our research, like we're contributing to the motor imagery community and, you know, getting really good research out there. And there might be some years like the COVID years where yeah. it's just definitely not a linear impact. And we're just.
Yes. And something that Heather said recently on our yeah. podcast was, well, you know, actually Heather's episode's coming out after this, so it's going to be very confusing. But she, in the future, says
yes.
that her research, like, it picks up in popularity at like times that you just wouldn't expect.
Right. Remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's definitely not linear. Yeah. You're not going to find some sort of groundbreaking result yeah. and then have it picked up right away all the time, you know?
Yeah. So. And I think that's another important point of, I know here the REF framework takes place every 7 years. And I think it's important. Like, I wonder what experts in the field would think about it taking place every 7 years, because mm-hmm. I feel like on Heather's point, it's important to reassess research, and I'm wondering if they're reassessing like the same, if they're compiling and just building on the research they're assessing,
mm-hmm.
Because, like, what if something in, like, 7 years ago isn't being picked up, but it's actually having a huge impact now, right?
Yeah.
So that would be interesting to look into, and any experts out there can kind of give us some insights.
Continue doing your jobs out there. And we're just merely reflecting on
it. So the next speaker we had was Sean Newell. He was from Elsevier, also the CEO of Interfolio. And his presentation and a lot of the discussion we had afterwards was all about measuring research impact. And while there are all these different ways to characterize research impact, such as significance, reach, tangibility, novelty, durability, collaboration, transferability, policy relevance, and engagement, a lot of different things, and I'm sure many more. What he really was trying to hone in on, and I think what a lot of the discussion and questions were, was that we might not just be able to agree on a single definition of what research impact is. And it, like you said earlier, it can change depending on the type of research you're doing, whether it's basic or applied, as well as what the overall goal of your research is. Like, some research really is just basic research, and we're just trying to figure out why A equals B, and, you know, that's the impact.
That is the impact, So he was, firstly, Sean is a really good speaker. I was very impressed, and I think he actually has at least one book written out there. So if you're interested in his research impact stuff, definitely give him a Google. But it's this, the definition thing is huge, I think. I don't even know if going into the conference, if I even had a definition of research impact. But he did make a good point. So all those things that you listed is, like, we can probably agree that we can characterize impactful research based on its significance, based on who does it reach and how tangible it is. But it's not, like, all these different characteristics might not be true for every research project. So it's like, while we can't agree on a single definition, there are things that we can agree about. So that's, I think that's a good thing.
And I think it's important to recognize that research impact is going to have a changing definition depending on the area that you're in, right? Like, if you think about within Canada, the CIHR grants, their research impact and what they're looking at is totally different than when we apply to NSERC. You know, they want to know, like, how is this impacting health, society, actual patients, members of the community, versus NSERC is like, we just want to know the basic science.
And I like that there is a distinguishment. Because we are being evaluated in different ways, which I think is good. And I do think that finding a one-size-fits-all solution might not be the way to go about it. As a non-expert, that's my opinion. But when has one-size-fits-all really
Ever worked, right?
Ever worked,
it's like,
you know?
It makes sense that there wouldn't be.
So I think it's good that we have some sort of different criteria. So the next sort of big, what would I call this, like, segment, maybe, that we went to, sub-session, was something called Training Science and Society to Engage. So this was run by three different experts. So we have David Butts Peterson, who's a professor of science communication. What a cool job.
I know.
At Aalborg University. And then we have Rhonda Moore, the executive director, science and innovation at the Institute of Governance. And then we had Sandra Lapointe, a professor in philosophy at McMaster. So they came together to talk about engaging society with science. And they came up with what I think is a beautiful sentence.
It was very well-written sentence.
Well-written sentence on the over, like, arching theme of the session, which is, there can be no impact assessment without skills and capacity. So organizational cultures have to change to become more conducive for knowledge brokering at the individual and collective level, driven by funders, universities, intermediaries, and scientists. So if you don't know what that means right off the bat, I think what really they were trying to say is that we need the skills to translate the knowledge. And this is a responsibility at both the individual and collective level. We are talking about funders, universities, the scientists themselves, the people who are intermediate to these processes. We need to, like, knowledge is not, it's not, it's like one half of the
half
coin.
Half of the coin, right? Yes. You have to be able to get the knowledge out there to those that need it.
Yes.
And, you know, the stakeholders that are mm-hmm. really involved in whatever your research is looking at. And I think this next point that you put here, that knowledge production isn't the problem. It's how we understand the knowledge that we need and the capacity to use it yeah. is really important.
Yes.
Because that, I mean, right there, I feel like that encompasses any impact. You mm-hmm. know, you can say the knowledge based off of how a single cell is constructed versus how, you know, a stroke patient is rehabilitated. I feel like that sentence encompasses all of that we need to understand the knowledge and how we need to use it and in what capacity.
Yeah. This reminds me of this course that I took during COVID, the Science of Happiness. It was a course run by some Yale professor, and yeah. me and my brother, we were like weekly attending these lectures. And one of the lessons was that knowing is not half the battle. Mm. And I really liked that. She really just called us out on, like, you probably know a lot of different ways that are supposed to make you happy, you know, whether that's eating well, exercising, spending time with family, whatever. These are things that are,
you know,
but are you really putting it into practice was what she was saying. And I think this is very similar here. Mm. And it's like, yeah, I think that it happens a lot. It's we, as students, we probably know a lot, but are we actually being given the skills to use what we know, right? And I think there's a lot of movement towards that. I think that we're, like, Dell Innovates is, like, a big program that's trying to drive science into the community.
Yes, more knowledge translation.
Mm-hmm. And I think we have a lot of grad PD professional development workshops that's also trying to increase our skills. We have the Open Think program at Dell to, you know, bring PhD students into writing for the public and not just scientific writing. So there's a lot of things happening. But like this sentence says, it's not just the individual level. We need to think about our funders and our universities. And
because as much as we can do these things, if, you know, all these personal development workshops or being a part and going to, like, the Dell Innovate program, if those aren't measured as our scientific impact
and
you need to keep your job, like, what are you going to drop if it comes to it? You know?
Exactly. There needs to be a way to show that this is leading us towards something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So another thing that was talked about in this session, since it is called Training Science and Society to Engage, they brought up a really interesting, I guess, scientific myth that I'm not, like, a history buff, so I didn't know this, but apparently there was this myth that science won the Second World War, and the Treaty on Positives of Science, that society should fund science and society has autonomy, and then science is accountable to society in exchange for the benefits that society gets from science.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a myth because there's no mention of equity, diversity, or inclusion.
Mm.
There's no mention of how these benefits that are broadly spoken about from science are reaching society. And then there's also the complexity of science and technology. So they mentioned that this post-war contract doesn't consider that scientists should not be the representatives of society and that science actually needs to work with society to innovate with it and not for it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good – I really like that sort of, like, I don't know what I would call that example.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Well, I mean, this has been something that's been pretty drilled into my mind ever since I got out of high school, I think, is, like, there's a lot of, like, in healthcare, you hear a lot about, like, I, as a health caregiver or as a researcher, I'm not here to decide what's wrong with you and then to decide your best treatment.
Yes.
I'm here to listen to you.
Yeah.
And you tell me what you need from me.
Yeah.
And then I will collaborate with you. And so it's kind of like this patient-centered care is what we're saying. It's like society-centered science kind of thing,
because
right?
If if science is supposed to benefit society,
yes,
then
yeah,
society should really be this at the center of it.
But as society, if you just get somebody who's, you know, supposedly sitting in their little labs doing clickety clackety whatever they're doing, and they're like, you need this,
yeah,
even though you were peacefully just you know, floating down your river doing nothing, I didn't realize you needed anything, right? Yeah. So it's I think we have a lot to learn from that.
Yeah, I think there's also, you know, the challenge, and this is not at all to society's fault. I think it's just long lived throughout the years, even this like post-war social contract for science, that it's hard for scientists and society to engage with one another, you know, and there's no fault on society's part. No fault on scientists' part, you know, like, but maybe, I don't know. But, yeah, it's hard to get all the stakeholders at the table, and not only at the table, because I feel like now this is a theme that, like, you have representatives of everyone at the table, but not everyone has an equal voice at the end of the day. So it's like, what's the point?
Well, I think that brings us quite nicely into our next point, which is we're thinking of science and society as being like two entities. However, we can break up the types of scientists that we have. We have knowledge generators that would be the people like us who are in the lab. And then we have the knowledge synthesizers who I brought this up so many times, but it's like the divers versus the swimmers. So the divers are the generators. They look at the specific problems. The synthesizers are the swimmers who like take all the divers' information and aggregates them to kind of find the significance on these projects. And then we have the knowledge brokers who translate those that science into the benefit of policy and stakeholders. And then we have the policy evaluators who review the outputs, because, you know, once it's out there, we can't just be like, oh, not our problem anymore.
You have it, go ahead.
And so we need a collaboration of all these types of scientists, people, to work together and not, you know, put the responsibility on just
an individual
person. So, you know, I wonder if there is, like, any, like, well-moving, well-oiled train that's just doing this right now.
I mean, I feel like in probably very prevalent in vaccine research, you know, there has to be the knowledge generators, the synthesizers. Then there's the knowledge brokers that go to the government and the policy and stakeholders. And then the policy evaluators that go on TV and put it out and say, hey, we have this COVID vaccine. It's safe. It's, you know, all these things. So I feel like that field probably has it honed in pretty well.
I do think that it's really hard to distinguish the generator from the synthesizer.
Because I was thinking, I feel like we are both. As graduate students, we are both, you know.
And I think the biggest thing is, like, the generator has, like, the ability to synthesize all of the findings that they've had over many years, over collaborations, over research that they're reading. But also, like, sometimes that's a bad thing because they're too
in it.
So it's, I think it's hard, and it makes you wonder, like, oh, should specific grad students be, like, you know, the specific the
more data.
But then it goes to the question of, like, but they haven't worked with it. So, you know, I don't know. I don't have any answers for that, but very, very interesting. Food for thought for sure.
So on our second day, we attended a subsection called From EDI to Inclusive Research in Societal Impact. And this was run by Dr. Omnisor Dryden, the associate professor, also James Robinson Johnson Endowed Research Chair in Black Canadian Studies, Faculty of Medicine, interim director of the newly established Black Studies in STEM Research Institute at Dalhousie University. And it was also run by someone else, right?
Dr. Melinda Smith.
Dr. Melinda Smith, the Vice Provost and Associate Vice President, EDI, and a Professor of Political Sciences at the University of Calgary. I actually didn't know she was from the university. I don't know why. I assumed she was here.
She really made herself
at home. I was like, yes, you're at Dal.
You're at Dal now. They're both, like, very accomplished.
I have to say, I think this was my favorite subsection that I attended. It was, I think the what would we have, like an hour and 10 minutes of time? Mm-hmm. I just, oops, the information that these two wonderful people put into their subsection is just, like, I'm so thankful for it. So,
yeah, yeah. I know. I honestly really enjoy going to EDI talks, but sometimes they're not done very well.
Very well, yes. They have to – I find – what I like about both of these is they very much came from their perspective.
Yes.
You know, being Black women, talking about race theory, which, I mean, we can get into everything that we talked about. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how you do an EDI talk well, as coming from a non-professional.
Yes. And another thing, especially Dr. Omisor H. Dryden did extremely well, is bringing in, like, personal stories and stuff like that, where it's, like, very impactful for the listeners.
Yes.
So, yeah, I'll let you give a brief rundown.
So, the first speaker, Dr. Omisor Dryden, she spoke about colorblindness that comes from white privilege, how slavery continues to impact the health of African Nova Scotians, systemic anti-Black racism affects the health of Black people, and critical race theory, which basically rejects the philosophy of colorblindness. And understands race as a creation of society, not a biological reality. So this is like analyzing the way that race is produced, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really liked all the points that she brought up. So this was the first time I've ever heard about critical race theory, but I feel very in line with it, in line with what it suggests. And it was something that was first brought up to me without – like coining the term critical race theory in an anthropology class, where we really did like a deep dive into what race is and how much it isn't a biological reality. And the thing is I was raised in like quite a religious family where the concept of evolution wasn't even – so a lot of this was very new and eye-opening for me. And I think this is another good example of where knowledge isn't enough.
Yes.
Because I think if you talk to most people on the street, like, and you tell them that race is a creation of society, not a biological reality, I think most people would agree.
Yeah.
But I think what people don't understand – is that because of the previous thought that race was a biological reality, we have like years and years of, you know, kind of affecting the health of Black people, and not just Black people, but because of how poorly we treated them and how this like systemic anti-Black racism, that's what causes a lot of the disparities that we see. It's not because solely the fact that they're black which is what it seems like on the surface level, right? And so I think it's a very eye-opening theory that needs to be talked about a lot more. But I would really like to see how it works in action too. It's like once you know, like, what I would like to know, like, a lot of things that are happening to help combat this systemic racism that still continues today, you know? I really liked her talk. And so when we were writing out our notes for this, a lot of Dr. Omisor Dryden's speech was, like, so encapsulating that we didn't really write
too much.
So it was a bit difficult to give, like, a really encompassing
overview.
But a lot of the stories were very, like, impactful. And if you ever get a chance to hear her speak, really.
Or she has any talks out there that you could Google, that would be, she won a teaching award in the Faculty of Medicine that I know she said she was very proud of.
Yeah.
And I believe I'm not sure the exact class that she teaches, but she teaches about like systemic anti-Black racism and how it affects the health, and as a, you know, medical provider, you know, how you can have those impacts on Black people and African Nova Scotians. So, you know, I feel like as a Black professor coming in to the medical school and teaching about a subject that might make some people uncomfortable, you know, something that you have to kind of face head on. Mm-hmm. It's really, it is impactful. And I can, you know, I can only imagine what it meant for them to win a teaching award that was, you know, all student led, the award. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. So definitely go seek out their teachings, I think.
Yes.
I think it's very impactful.
Yeah, definitely.
So then our second speaker, Dr. Melinda Smith, very similar situation, very encapsulating. Yes. So
notes are sparse.
Notes are sparse, but the main question that they tried to address was, how do you go from equity, diversity, and inclusion in the university to bringing that into society?
Yes.
And so it's the same sort of question we're addressing in the whole conference, but focusing on a specific topic. And so I think the biggest thing that I took out from this was looking at how we define things.
Yes.
So similar, it's kind of like a very similar to day one, but we have the capacity to create terms, to create understanding, especially as scientists from the university, right? And so I think like a lot of what her talk was about was just not using these terms interchangeably.
Yes, and loosely.
And loosely, and making sure that you can define things and have a clear definition and understanding the impact of each definition that you bring in. And she had a very overwhelming slide of all the definitions.
Yes.
And I was like, commit all of these to memory right now, but I couldn't. Good thing we get the slides.
You do get the slides. Yeah.
So, yeah. Some other things that Dr. Smith brought into her talk was about how a lot of equity, diversity, and inclusion is not a passive thing.
No. Yeah.
It requires active participation.
Yes.
And what this reminds me of is those, like, super keen climate scientists who, like, are always being activists for what they believe in.
Yes.
And people disregarding them.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, you can't disregard these people because These are our primary example of what we should be doing.
Yeah.
Right? Like we don't bring about change by just
like
passively being
like, this is our new document, this is our new standard. We are in this university, we support EDI and that's it.
And that's it. Or here I am.
Fill the quotas.
Yeah, here I am, a research lab. Everyone take an EDI course. Mm-hmm. Okay, you've fulfilled it.
Sweet.
You're done, you know, right? Like
This
is something that needs to be an active engagement. And people who study this and who are advocates for this, you know it. And they're so good at active participation, right? And it's like, it's things like, you know, I don't know exactly. I don't think I have like the best advice on how to actively participate.
Yeah.
But I think that most people, when they are sitting in a conversation that doesn't sit right with them, being able to like speak up, stuff like that. Oh yeah, go back to your point.
Something that I really appreciate in this talk and that I'm going to try and always work in more into any conversations, and especially with topics about like EDI, equity, diversity, and inclusion, as I'm about to say this, is really not just saying things like, yes, critical race theory and EDI, but explaining it.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps other people wrap their head around it. Because I feel like there's this assumption that everyone has a base knowledge, or that by creating the term critical race theory, like you said, you learned about this in anthropology, there was just, you know, the term wasn't there.
Yeah.
While these terms are helpful and useful, like any type of overbranching arc, I think it does contribute to losing the definitions and the meanings.
Yes.
And using them interchangeably. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to really try hard. Anytime I use like a term or a definition, I'm going to define it after I say it.
Active participation.
Yes.
But the thing is like, if you think about yourself as a human, right? Having people either like talk down to you or talk to you about things that they just assume you know is not a good feeling.
Yeah.
And some of those like EDI, here I am using the acronym, but some of the EDI workshops that I've been to before, sometimes the tone of them is like, you should have known this, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that to have some sort of like engagement with people who are very far removed from it, you need to approach it from a perspective of like not talking down to them because they don't know. I do think, you know, to some level, like, ignorance on their part is not your responsibility. No. And they do need to take responsibility for themselves. But if they're there actively ready to engage with you, and I do think that it benefits both of you to really, like, I think it for any subject, to really talk at a level of that both can understand it. So I do think that's a really good point to not just throw terms out and just assume.
Yeah, and just be like, yep. And
then I know exactly like, what this means.
I know that too.
And so some of the sort of active participation that Dr. Melinda Smith brought up was the inclusion, like to include diverse communities, to engage with those who have lived experiences. This is huge. This comes up over and over again. And to collaborate or to have collaborative engagement science and to look at ripple effects so you can improve your research question, your methods, your practices of engagement, the data quality and the interpretation. And that improves public engagement with science and embeds societal relevance and improves credibility of the results. And just so once you start something, it can ripple. I think that that's I think
they ended on a very hopeful point that, you know, we have these tools. It's putting them into practice and being that active participant. Mm-hmm.
And I do think that part of it is, like, being okay to be uncomfortable.
Yes.
And being okay with not knowing.
Yeah, and not always being – yes, as you said, being uncomfortable, not always knowing the right thing to say or do. And this is why we also, you know, consult and collaborate with diverse communities and those with lived experiences.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. And if you put yourself in that uncomfortable space and you try to be active in it, you can make mistakes. But as we know, learning happens
with mistakes,
right?
Yes.
And so
it's my research.
So I think it's okay to be uncomfortable and to embrace it and to really try to be an active part of it, whether that's seeking out workshops, seeking out information. There's tons and tons of resources out there, but also actively practicing it. I think I know a lot about this from a healthcare perspective, right? Yeah. Not just assuming about like illnesses or symptoms based on a person's appearance, right? And really, like, not letting like stereotypes or previous bias really influence like healthcare. But I think it comes into our research as well in how we interact with participants who come how we interact with each other, how we consider looking into hiring policies and all these different things. Like, there's a lot of different areas in which you can participate, right?
Definitely.
The next big subsection that we went to was more of a workshop.
Yes.
So this was called Societal Impact of Open Science, Knowledge Transfer and Misinformation. So big fancy title for basically engaging with the concept of open science. So open science, for those of you who are unaware of what it is a movement to make scientific processes and practice, including research methodology and outputs, more open and transparent. So this can exist in a few ways: open data, open access, open methodology, open source. So open source could be things like open source programming languages, open peer review, and open education, where open education is like having open access to courses and not having to pay for those kinds of things. And so I think we're not going to spend too much time on this, but I think the biggest thing is this is a great movement.
Yes. There's a lot of positives and benefits.
There's a lot of positives, lots of benefits. For example, we're increasing accessibility. Mm-hmm. Other things are, you know, it seems
having that open peer review.
Yeah, it seems kind of wrong to generate all this knowledge and then just gatekeep it for ourselves, right? Like having people being able to access this information and inform themselves in their own ways, right?
Collaborate with other scientists.
Yeah. And I think, like, the one that I think of the most is, like, open source. Like, mm-hmm. for me, wanting to learn how to code, not having to pay for resources yes. is very helpful. And using something that there's just a huge community of people who are just, like, on the internet who yeah. tells me how to solve problems and stuff. It's super cool. But the thing is open science, I don't think, is enough.
No.
You know, it's a really good starting point. It's a really good stepping stone. But it doesn't help to address all forms of misinformation.
Yes.
Right? You get open science into the wrong hands, they misinterpret it, and here we are believing in myths or yes. something, or we're accessing things to facilitate our point of view and we're not considering the full picture.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we're coding something that has the effect to it can affect someone's well-being and health, but we're not expert coders.
Don't know what
right?
our code is doing. Yes.
Exactly. Like, there's definitely things to consider.
Yeah, I think open science alone is not the answer.
Mm-hmm, I think so too.
There needs to be that knowledge translation in
yes,
there.
Yes, exactly.
There has to be those stakeholders in there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's just, sometimes it's like, you know, we're like, oh, well, we made it open access yeah. and there you go.
Yeah,
we've checked off the box.
Like, yeah.
yeah, like whatever.
Yeah.
No, I think we need to do
and,
more.
Yeah, and I mean, even if we even just think about open science and people say, you know, it's like accessible science. It's like, not really.
Yeah.
Because like someone who, you know, is hard of seeing or is blind,
yeah.
you know, if you put your code out there on the internet, it's not going to help them.
Exactly, exactly. You know, like, and I think someone always brings it up in conversations about open science. There's always going to be that person who says, who's paying for it?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
it's always like, something to consider,
yeah,
right?
What's the benefit to the actual work and output that it takes.
Yeah, yeah. But that's not to say I'm definitely a proponent
oh,
of
yes.
open science.
No.
I'm just saying that you can't use it as an excuse.
No.
You can't use it as an excuse, and I think we need to do more than just have it.
Yeah.
All right, so going on to our last
one,
do you want to introduce it?
Yes. Our last subsection that we went to was a workshop all about how to tell a powerful story. So they had person who works in knowledge translation
yes.
And storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, they're working at Sick Kids Hospital. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you remember their name.
Ranira Narendes.
There we go, Ranira.
Okay. Yeah.
So she started off with an amazing spoken word about one that she does about Sick Kids Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that in itself, I feel like for a workshop, you're captivated and you're like, okay, I'm ready to listen to you.
Exactly.
So that was great. But I think she had like – we have three main points here, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that scientists are bad at telling stories, you know?
Yeah, I hate to break it.
We really like our numbers and our graphs and our info and our p-value.
And, oh, man, if you're a scientist out there, you know. But,
yeah.
like, why do we do these poster
right presentations?
Our poster presentations. Like, it's like, firstly, making them a pain. Secondly, being an audience in a poster presentation.
It's like, I don't want to look at your poster if you're going to talk to me.
Exactly.
Like, I can't do both.
And then, like, lastly, it's just like, who decided that this was
right?
the best method for communicating science?
Yeah.
But that's not to say that the posters that I've made, I've been very proud of.
Yes. Yeah,
it's like
sure.
we love them,
yeah.
but are
it's
they
not,
the best?
Yeah.
You know,
no.
I don't know if they're the best
yeah.
way.
And I think to that point, something that scientists can work on is in their communication skills and their skills of storytelling and getting their point across. And I think a really good thing that she mentioned, because some people might think storytelling like, oh, of course, yeah, she works at Sick Kids Hospital and she's telling stories about sick children and more things that are a person can grasp. But she really honed in on the point that like, anyone has a story, no matter
mm-hmm.
what research you're doing, the little cells you're looking at, like there's a story and you can find it. And personal stories are the most impactful. So whether that story is about your research or about who it's helping, about your own research journey, about the students in your lab, like these are all things that you can draw into your science
mm-hmm.
and tell that personal side of the story in order to captivate your audience.
Mm-hmm.
A second point to that is knowing your audience.
Yes.
So when you go to your thesis defense. Do not tell a personal story. They don't want to hear that. They want to hear the facts.
Yeah, exactly.
That is the one time where, yes, you can be a bad quote-unquote storyteller. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, in your thesis defense, you can also, you know, have those aspects of improving your storytelling while still having the data and the facts that your committee is looking for. Mm-hmm. But if you're, you know, going to a funding agency or say you're trying to venture out into industry, you might want to relook at how you're telling the story of your science mm-hmm. to make it more digestible and impactful to others.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I agree with her that, you know, the way scientists present their research is, you know, kind of boring, but I don't want to have just pictures if I'm a student in a lecture. Mm-hmm. Like, I want you to include like text writing, on your slide,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But if you're going to a conference
for sure.
Or you're doing something like a little presentation for your mom and dad, you know? So, yeah. like, those are good times yeah. to maybe include storytelling.
Yeah, practice some of those skills.
Yeah, yeah, and one example that I really like is from Austin in our lab. So it's we do research on motor imagery, yeah. and every single presentation ever starts with motor imagery mm-hmm. is the imagination or, well, usually people say the mental rehearsal of an action yeah. without overt movement or whatever, right? But Austin was like, look at this cat. And then he told the story about a cat and how it jumps to a window. But before it jumps, it does like a little like, you know, it like it basically does the jump in its head first mm-hmm. before it does the jump. Yeah. And it's like, this like cat assesses. Is performing motor imagery. And so things like that, those are impactful.
Just a little. And it just takes that one sentence just to capture your audience. And they're like, what are they talking about?
Exactly. Exactly. All right. So that sums up all of the subsessions yes. that we went to and kind of all of the important information that we took out of the yes. societal impact
and
of science.
And of course, we couldn't cover everything.
No.
As well as there were some things that were just completely out of our scope.
Yes, yes.
We learned a lot, but obviously yes. We wanted to speak to things that we felt we could really share confidently our point of view.
Exactly.
And what we learned.
Yeah. So if we're going to do just a little bit of a conclusion, yes. our overall thoughts and takeaways, well, firstly, fantastic conference.
Yes.
We'd love to great. Go to get yeah. again if that's possible. It happens all over the world.
Yeah.
So if you're listening, if we have an international audience, make sure you keep your eye out for it. But the main thing is measuring research impact is not a linear process.
Yeah.
And it is difficult to define.
Yeah.
And so that, I feel like that's like the
that
overall.
That was the overall. The difficult to define yes. was very much an overall statement in all 3 days.
Yeah. And like we said, like comparing applied versus
basic research.
Yeah. But that being said, we are definitely making progress, whether mm-hmm. that's creating frameworks like yes. DORA or the REF
yeah.
and guidelines for how we measure
Having
research impact.
Different funding agencies for different areas of research, mm-hmm. which we have here in Canada.
And then considering equity, diversity, and inclusion
yes.
and really like making that a point and a consideration in academia
yeah.
and in society. And then I think this sentence came up a few times, and our recollection of it is quite poor.
Yeah.
But something about the lines of we don't only need quantitative measures
yeah.
of impact, right? We need to consider qualitative, mm-hmm. meaning stories.
Yeah.
So numbers need stories, and stories need numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's like two sides of the puzzle, you know? You need both of them.
Exactly.
And I think that really sums up a lot of what we covered because mm-hmm. just like numbers need stories and stories need numbers.
Knowledge needs numbers, needs stories, needs numbers.
Numbers need stories. Where is the word? Knowledge generators need knowledge synthesizers, which need knowledge brokers, which need policy evaluators.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I think another thing that just came up in our discussion today is the whole thing about knowing is not
enough. Yeah.
Yeah. And that we do need to actively address these problems and like maybe respond like how we did during COVID, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, we like really put together resources to benefit the greater good. I know that it's an unrealistic expectation to do that all the time. But we're headed in the right direction.
And I mean, this conference was well attended, had, as you can see, amazing speakers beyond what we've talked about. Mm-hmm. So there's good people working towards this, you know?
Exactly, exactly. And they get to actually come together and work together.
And work together and collaborate internationally, mm-hmm. multidisciplinary, you know? Yeah.
And just like side note, they also made it very engaging. We went to a Family Feud event.
Oh, that was best.
Yeah, and all the personalities were just very fun and very engaging with all different people. So, if you ever get a chance, check it out.
It was a great experience.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Teresa, for chatting with me
Thank you, Juliet.
Yeah, it was just –
It was fun. I'm glad I attended it with you. I'm happy that we were able to be guests of the university.
Yes, and I'm happy that it happened at Dalhousie.
Dalhousie.
So very convenient for both of us. Yeah. And apparently that was due to Alice.
Yes, Alice Aiken.
Dr.
Who
Alice.
Will be –
on our podcast.
On our podcast.
In probably like a month and a half. So look forward to it. All right. Thank you. Up next, Out of Pocket with Olivia.
All my life, I have dragged around a variety of reusable water bottles no matter where I have been. Airplanes, sports events, classrooms, and even meals at restaurants, I will still tend to have my trusty water bottle with me. It has become a habit and feels like second nature to me. It has become so easy that I no longer really think about it. Sometimes it's not even filled before I leave the house if I don't have time to fill it, but I still take it with me because I'm so used to having it. So the fact that plastic water bottles are still an everyday use item for so many people who have access to clean tap water boggles my mind. Not only is it wasteful to go through so many single-use bottles that, might I add, are not easily or effectively recycled, but also, the water really isn't that good. I know many people swear by their favorite brands of bottled water, but I have never even been a fan of a single type of bottled water. So, this is a shout-out to people who would rather drink tap water than bottled water. You don't owe anyone an explanation.
Well, thank you for listening to our podcast, Mind the Gap. I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And this was recorded at CKDU.